Okay, this is Wayne Ranney down at Phantom Ranch in the Bart Angel Campground, and I'm down here February 18, 19, 20, and 21, interviewing Shores Horseman, Phantom Ranch volunteer for the last 33 years. And this is just an introduction to let you know it's a beautiful sunny day. It's absolutely cloudless. The temperature is supposed to get 71 today down here at Phantom Ranch. And I'd like to introduce you to Shores, who is a very famous personality here at Phantom Ranch. And Shores, can you just say and spell your name for us?
Yeah, my name is Shores, or it's actually pronounced Shores. And but I always tell people that it's like the seashore, so people can easier remember my name. I was born in Weesp, in Holland, or the Netherlands.
How do you spell that?
Weesp. It's W-E-E-S-P.
Oh, okay.
And it's about 10K from the Amsterdam.
Amsterdam.
Yeah, and I was there for like 4 years, and then my parents immigrated to the U.S., and we were sponsored. We came across the Atlantic on a ship called the SS United States, which was at the time the fastest ship. And then...
What year would that have been that you were on the...
It would be 1960.
1960, and who sponsored you?
It was some church group out of Hollywood.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, and so we did not know where we were going. Now, I don't remember any of this, so
yeah.
This is what my parents told me. But so we met the sponsors in New York, jumped on a train, and that's when we found out that we were going to Hollywood. And then we took a train, and the train was kind of an old-fashioned train. So when the... When the train engine would go up, then bing, 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 all the other ones would go, have a delayed reaction. And my parents were like, oh, my God, is this America? They're so backwards.
The trains were better in Holland.
Yeah, the trains were better in Holland. But then in Chicago, we switched to the Santa Fe, and then all of a sudden it was smooth going.
So that would have been the first time you saw the Southwest was coming on the Southwest
Chief? Yeah. But I don't remember any of it.
Right.
Yeah. My parents said I slept through the whole thing. And then in Albuquerque, they actually was able to go out of the train, and they went out on the trail on the train. I think it was like in June or something like that.
June of 1960.
Yeah. And it was hotter, you know, pretty hot outside. So they jumped, walking out of the train, and they're like, God, it's hot out here. And then they jumped back in the train. Yeah, so anyway, so we ended up in Hollywood, and sponsored by this church group. And we lived there for like a year, and then we started going on our own. My dad made enough money to get a car. Now, we had a car in Holland, too, and a boat. But it was a little more minor. Now all of a sudden, my dad had a Ford Galaxy, and it was 8-cylinder. So that was a big
a big boat of a car.
Yeah, it was. Yeah, and then we end up camping all the time. So we for the first 10 years we camped every weekend and didn't miss a one. And it never rained on us. That was kind of one of the bizarre things. It never rained on us after, you know, coming from Holland. And then every summer, we would go on these two-month trips hitting the national parks of Western Canada and Western United States.
Yeah. So what is your first memory? You said you don't remember any of this, and you've heard the stories from your parents. I'm just curious, what was your first memory?
Oh, my very first memory actually was in Holland.
Okay.
I was, it's when I first saw snow. And we were on like these slotted apartments, you know, in a block that's one building. And I looked out the window and I saw snow falling, and I knew And I never seen it before. I knew what it was. I said, snow. And yeah, that was pretty neat. And then I had this, where I played was on a balcony, a little balcony. And I had this little cart, and I made this big old snowball. And then for some weird, well, I don't know why I remembered it, but after I built it, the snowball split in half exactly.
Huh. Yeah, your first memory in the United States?
Let's see. Then my first memory in the United States. I'm not sure what my first memory in the United States was.
Okay, well, what comes to mind when you think, was it, I guess you said you lived in South Central Los Angeles, close to the Forum?
Yeah, so after the first year in Hollywood, we moved to Inglewood, and we were more on our own. And, so that's pretty much where I grew up.
Okay.
In Inglewood.
So maybe the first thing you remember is from Hollywood or Inglewood.
Yeah, it would be, probably. And I think I remember camping trips.
A camping trip.
Yeah.
Where? Do you remember a camping trip to a particular place?
Well, so on the weekends, we went to places like, what's that lake? Lake Hicetas?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, by Ojai.
Yeah.
Yeah, and we would go sometimes to Baldy, Joshua Tree. Yeah, so we definitely made our rounds, yeah.
So your parents were campers in Holland?
Yeah, so we had a little car, Morris Minor, and we had the boat. So we, same thing, every weekend we would go out and go camping either with the boat or the car.
What denomination was the church that sponsored you?
I think it was Catholic.
It was Catholic.
Yeah,
okay.
So my dad wasn't very religious.
He did it because of your mom.
No, it just said it was, we were being sponsored when you, apparently there's, in those days when you immigrate to the United States, you were being sponsored.
Oh, I see. It wasn't that the church brought you over, but it was that your parents wanted to come to the United States.
Yes.
And they had to find a sponsor, and the Catholic Church did it.
Yeah.
Okay. Cool. I'm just going to stop here for a second, make sure we're recording. We've already got... Okay, so we're recording again. We are recording, and Shorce, can you just tell us your birthday?
12, December 14, 1955.
Okay, and where we stopped off, you were immigrated to the United States. You were camping with your parents, and just pick up with Inglewood, any place you like.
So we lived in Inglewood. And then we did these like camping trips, and one of the trips that we used to go to is Yosemite Valley. And what was really neat was hiking. You know, my dad liked to do day hikes, so we would hit all the waterfalls during the day, and then at night sit in camp and watch the firefall.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, that was pretty neat. I mean, as a kid, that was pretty spectacular to watch.
You didn't stay in the cabins or the
Awani? No,
we were camping.
Yeah, we always camped.
Yeah.
And, we had one of those tall six-person tents, you know. And we had a system, so we can get it up, like, and we can set up camp in 10 minutes. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, so we were pretty organized. And then, we went into Canada, in the Canadian Rockies and stuff.
So I sense that these camping trips really had a big influence in
how
you eventually turned out.
Yeah. My dad was a painter, house painter, and he never thought about me being involved with Park Service, though. He was not quite sure why.
Huh. And what about your mother? She was a willing camper?
Oh, yeah, she was totally into it. You know, she is actually full-blooded Chinese.
Oh.
Yeah, and she was...
Was she born in China?
Never been in China.
She's never been.
Yeah, so my grandparents on her side were Chinese, and they immigrated to Indonesia, the island Sumatra.
Wow.
And she was born and lived in village. One of the villages she lived in was Bukittinggi, which is on Sumatra on the...
Can you spell that?
No.
Okay. Say it one more time, though.
Bukittinggi.
Bukittinggi on yeah. Sumatra. Okay.
Yeah. And during the war, she got hired by a hospital because she can speak Dutch. And so this during the war, the Dutch came military to fight with the Japanese. My dad was a Red Cross, so they met in the hospital.
Unbelievable. So now I see the connection. The Dutch were in Indonesia.
Yeah.
Your mother had emigrated there from China, and they met in
Indonesia. Yeah, well, actually, my grandparents did.
Yeah, okay.
And then she was born there. So she'd never been to China. So the, and then they got married, and then they moved to Holland and for 10 years, and then eventually here.
And what were your father's and mother's names?
My father's name is Peter Horstman.
Okay.
And my mom is Els.
E-L-S?
No, it's E-L-S-J-E.
E-L.
It's actually pronounced Elsha.
Okay.
But so the food that I ate was Chinese, Indonesian, and Dutch.
Oh my gosh, you probably had satay before satay was fashionable.
Yeah, so well, satay to us is a little different than what's in the United States, yeah.
Unbelievable, that's great.
Yeah.
Wow, that's very interesting. So you guys are doing a lot of camping. Do you remember the address of the house you lived in Inglewood?
I just remember 109th
Street. 109th
Street. Yeah.
That is so interesting. My great-grandparents lived on 110th Street. Might have actually been Compton, though. I don't know how the geography is there. We would visit them, but I think 110th was.
Yeah, so we actually, from Hollywood, we first also was 110th. But then quickly we moved to 109th, but we were in the same line. We could see the whole house right behind the thing. We had a nice little backyard and stuff.
So I think most people who will listen to this think of this part of the world, Inglewood and Compton and what is known as South Central LA, and they just think, oh my God, what an urban jungle. Did you have any outdoor places, or like when you guys weren't camping, what was a typical day like for you in Inglewood?
I was a street kid.
Okay.
And a beach bum.
Which beach? Redondo, Manhattan?
Manhattan Beach is probably the most.
Okay.
Yeah. And I would either hitchhike there, or I would walk there, or I would bicycle there. And because there's a railroad track I could take.
An east-west railroad track.
Well, yeah, it kind of cut because, you know, all the roads are straight, but if you took the tracks, you got a more straighter line.
Wow.
Yeah, but, so I would spend the day there and stuff. And I also got, I went to Morningside High School.
Okay.
And it's not far. It's under the flight path, or almost right on the flight path of LAX.
Okay.
So we had a lot of interruptions in class, but when I got older, I got into doing rock concerts, and I got into classical jazz and rock, and the Forum being so walking distance made it really easy for me to go to a lot of them. So I actually logged in 126 concerts.
Do you remember your first concert?
I'm not quite sure, but it was probably, I think it was Grand Funk Railroad was my first one.
Okay.
Yeah. The Black Sabbath was just had their album out, their first album, which I really liked.
Yeah.
And so I went to a Black Sabbath concert at the Forum, and it was only like $3.50. There was an opening band, and it was Yes.
Oh my God!
Yeah, and I immediately fell in love with Yes, and then became a much bigger Yes fan than ever a Black Sabbath fan.
I'm the same way.
Oh, yeah?
My very first concert was a Led Zeppelin concert in 1970 at the Forum, and Black Sabbath opened for them.
Oh, really? Wow, yes. That's a trip.
So I'm thinking that your first concert with Grand Funk Railroad and then the Black Sabbath one was probably a little bit after, because Black Sabbath was still opening for the main act.
Yeah.
But you saw Black Sabbath as the main act.
Yeah, it was the main act, yeah.
Wow, that's a lot of concerts. And, you know, in previous trips down here to Phantom Ranch, probably 20 years ago, you and I figured out for sure that we were at an event called California Jam.
Yeah, California Jam 1.
Which was at the Ontario Motor Speedway. Yeah. At least 100,000 people. Sometimes I want to say 300,000, but that sounds too large.
Yeah, it was 250,000, quarter million.
Just unbelievable.
Yeah, it was unbelievable, yeah.
Why don't you just tell us about that day? I have my memories of it, but we're talking about you. Tell us about that California Jam.
Well, it was unbelievable. It was, at the beginning, it was slow going in because there were so many people. And then I remember there were two stations, KLS and KMAT.
Yes.
Yeah.
The main stations in LA.
Yeah, KMAT was broadcasting things, what was going on at the concert, and they were saying at the rate they were letting us into they were checking everybody, you know. Going in there, it will be hours before we get in there. And so when they heard that, they just opened the gates.
And yes, so, I remember that.
Yeah, and then they opened the gates. It was a peaceful, pretty much very peaceful concert, yeah.
It was very hot that day.
Yeah, it was hot.
Sun was blazing.
Yeah, and then they sent a helicopter with those water bottles.
Unbelievable.
Yeah, all the water bottle thing is something I will never forget. And then you run back at the fountains and fill them all up, yeah. Yeah, that was pretty amazing, yeah.
I remember it started out very slowly.
Yeah.
Somebody took a gallon jug filled with water and threw it into the air so that the water was streaming out and splashing people. And then it crescended and people started doing it where there were literally hundreds of water bottles flying through the air.
Yeah, and then, and also Black Sabbath sent a copter over and dropped visors, Black Sabbath visors.
Oh, you're kidding.
Yeah, that was.
I remember there were eight acts, but I only remember the final two. Number 7 was Deep Purple, and number 8 was Emerson, Lake, and Palmer.
Yeah.
Do you remember who else?
I think it started off with Rare Earth.
Yeah, okay.
And then Earth, Wind, and Fire.
Okay.
And I think Seals
and Crofts. Nice names for groups for you and I.
I think Seals and Crofts, wasn't it?
I really don't remember. I'd be surprised if it was the Eagles for some reason.
Yeah, I think it was, the Eagles were there, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, we could easily find this out online.
But, yeah, it was the Eagles. Black Oak, Arkansas.
I do remember that. Yeah. Black Oak, Arkansas.
Yeah, welcome to Jim Danny to the rescue. Yeah.
I remember I stayed till the very, very end. Most people had left.
Yeah, I stayed till the very end, yeah.
Did you?
Oh, yeah.
We were next to each other because there was hardly anybody there, and there were little campfires.
Everywhere.
People had lit a campfire by that time of the night. It was well dark.
Yeah, I remember because the person I was with, he had to go to the bathroom. And he goes, how am I going to find you back? And I said, well, just look for that fire over here. And then he went to the restroom, and then, time had passed. I said, oh, where's Brian? And then I looked back, and there were hundreds of fires, you know.
Incredible.
Yeah, so that was pretty funny. And then I spotted him. And then I go, Brian, and we got back together.
So it sounds like a lot of your late teen years and into your 20s, you were into rock concerts.
And classical and jazz.
And classical and jazz.
So I was even into Ravi Shankar.
Okay.
Yeah, I seen him too live.
So what were you doing for work at this time?
Well, in high school, I were making leather things, belts.
For someone or on your own?
Just on my own. And And then, you know, just sell it to the other kids, you know.
Oh.
For a dollar. For some of the wristbands were the ones they liked the most, yeah.
Okay, so leather wristbands.
Yeah.
And then you have probably two leather strings and you tie it around your
snap.
Wrist.
Snap.
And you would do custom things like put their name on it as a birthday
or their girlfriend or boyfriend's name on it, yeah.
You did that in high school. Do you remember what you sold those for?
A dollar,
okay. Yeah. Where would you buy the leather?
Tandy's.
Okay. Tangies?
Tandy, the Tandy leather store.
Okay.
Yeah,
okay.
And you can buy a skin of a half of a cow.
Okay.
And I had these tools and stuff.
How did you get into that?
You know, I don't know how I got into that. Okay. I also made some sandals. Those days had sandals and then you put a tire sole on it.
A huarache. Remember huaraches? That's what we call them. That's what they call them in Mexico, huaraches.
Then when I got into college, I went to El Camino College.
Two-year college in California.
Yes, yeah, like a junior college.
We call them junior colleges, right?
Yeah, and and then I started working for a... So I was learning electronics, and then I ended up... my teacher recommended me to a store that fixes TVs. So I started fixing TVs.
You're kidding.
Yeah, and I did that for about 6 years.
He taught you how to do that?
Yeah, well, the teacher, the instructor, and I guess he liked my work, and so he recommended me. And so I was like an outside technician. So I would go out and drive through, and the place was in Gardena. Yeah, and I didn't even have a car.
Huh.
Because I had to ride my bicycle from Gardena. From Gardena to Inglewood.
How far would that be?
It was probably like 5-6 miles.
Yeah, okay. What kind of bike did you have?
But, you know, but it's in scary neighborhoods.
Of course. And busy roads with cars driving fast.
Yeah.
It's L.A.
Yeah, so, yeah. And
did you have a 10-speed?
Yeah, I had a 10-speed. Also, I did a lot of hitching.
Yeah.
Yeah, hitching a lot. And I had really long hair at the time. And so... I would stand in the same place at the same time, like to go to El Camino. I'll go out there, and so people say this guy is here every morning, and so
get rides from the same people.
And then,
where's El Camino again?
It's in Torrance.
It's in Torrance.
Yeah, it's
okay.
near Gardena.
So you'd be hitchhiking south towards Torrance.
Yeah.
And then hitchhiking home. Did you see a lot of the same people hitchhiking home?
It was harder on the way home.
Okay.
It was definitely harder.
Okay.
But in the morning, it was... Because I didn't always get off at the same time, you know? Because I said I was... I had the van, so I would fix maybe 5 to 8 TVs a day.
And you'd go to the people's house and inside their house?
Yeah.
And was there a typical problem with the TV?
Well, I'm not like an electrician, like, you know, that's doing circuitry work.
Right.
So basically, I would like look at the TV, what was going on, and then tell me what circuits it's in.
Okay.
Yeah. And so then I would do the most obvious thing that would cause that problem, and I think that. And then if it's whether it was, you know, half of the TVs were picture, you know, were tubes still. And then they had what they call solid state.
Right.
Yeah. And so you get to know. And the company I worked for did like 5 different companies warranties. So I would do even warranty work, you know. So, and then instead of getting paid by the customer, I would take it back, and then the RCA or General Electric would pay us.
Okay.
Yeah.
Were you still living with your parents at this time?
I think I was still living with my parents.
So you were living with them through high school and then through El Camino College.
El Camino, and then somewhere along the line, that's right, and then they moved to Torrance.
Oh.
Yeah, and so I lived with them for a while, and then I finally got my own place, which was really not my own place. It belongs to somebody else that I worked with at the TV place. And I lived in the back room, and they had it closed off, so I couldn't go in that part of the house. They couldn't underline, and I had didn't have a kitchen, but I had a bathroom. And my boss gave me that's when microwaves were just beginning to come out. And so he gave me a display one that, you know, and it was just simple. It just had, you know, two buttons for high and low and a dial for a timer.
I remember those.
Yeah, yeah. And I kept that, actually, until not too long ago.
You're kidding.
Yeah, I had that.
Did you have it down here at Phantom
No,
Ranch?
Not here. I had it at my parents' house in Sedona.
Okay.
Yeah, so they, so anyway, yeah. You know, it was simple, so it works, you know.
Incredible.
Yeah.
So did the microwave fall under the auspices of the TV repair? Would you sometimes repair?
Yeah, when microwaves came out, there wasn't anybody. Yeah, for somehow TV repairmen end up doing microwaves.
Yeah, yeah, right.
Yeah.
An electric device that's rectangular and square and sits on the shelf. Yeah. That's like
but
a TV.
But I also did appliances a little bit because in the summertime there was all reruns. All right.
Yeah.
And it's beach time, so
right.
People didn't watch much TV.
Right.
And so I didn't have much work in the summertime, but people were washing clothes, you know, and stuff like that.
Oh,
so the appliance people from this company, it was a TV and appliance store, they would go in there, and sometimes they could find they didn't have the part, so then they can order the part and give it to me and say, you know, run over there and can you install this?
Oh, okay.
So I did a little bit of appliances.
And did you say Stevens Appliance?
Spears TV and Appliance.
Spears.
Yeah.
TV and Appliance. And it's in Torrance.
Yeah, it's in Gardena.
It's in Gardena.
Yeah, it's, let's see, I think it's Redondo Beach Boulevard.
Wow, yeah. You did that for 6 years.
Yeah.
So I'm guessing that when this was over, it was like you were 24 approximately?
I don't know, see. So it wasn't, anyway, while I was working, I started doing these trips, road trips. And then I would go on a road trip, and the road trips kept getting, and my boss keeps rehiring me. This kind of went for a while.
Oh, I see. You would actually quit the job and go on a road trip,
yeah.
And then he wanted you back.
Yeah, and anytime I came into his office, he'd go, oh, no, where are you going? You know. And then, yeah, and then I do remember in 1981, I did a big road trip. And that was drive around North America.
Holy cow.
And so I quit my job for it. And my boss said, well, if you suddenly break both your legs and you can't, you know, drive back, I will fly my son out and drive you back to here. And oh, no, okay, whatever. So I went. So the trip lasted almost a year.
Wow.
And I ended up driving 25,000 miles.
What were you driving?
A Datsun.
A Datsun sedan?
A station wagon.
The little boxy car.
Yeah, yeah, it was a used one. But I drove 25,000 miles, which is longer than the circumference of the planet.
Yes, it is. By 1,500 miles.
Yeah. And of course, in those days, it was easier to travel.
Yes.
Nobody did. There's no such thing as reservations.
Yeah.
And campgrounds who didn't have water were free.
Yeah.
Yeah, so I hit a lot of the forest lands, park service lands.
Did you make it into Canada? Mexico?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Definitely into Canada. I didn't go into Mexico.
Okay.
But I did. I pretty much crossed Canada. I went all the way to Cape Breton, Britain.
Yes.
Yeah, in Nova Scotia. I went to Prince Edward Island.
Wow.
Yeah, so I hit a lot of places, yeah.
And how far west would you have gone? Did you go to the Olympic Peninsula? Vancouver Island?
No, I didn't go there because I had been there before.
Okay.
Yeah, and previous trips.
Right.
Yeah, because I did a lot of road trips, yeah. And but that was the super long one, and even picked up a girlfriend on the way.
Wow, where did you meet her?
In Zion.
In Zion?
Yeah, I met her in Zion.
What was she doing? Was she hitchhiking? Or?
She was from Germany, and she was just kind of traveling, yeah. And she was with some other guy, but somehow I ended up with her.
So. Did she speak Dutch?
She spoke German.
Okay.
She knew a little bit of Dutch because she actually lived in a place called Bochum, which is just across the border from Holland.
Okay.
Yeah, and she was kind of an English teacher, but I think I probably messed up her English. Yeah, because we were together. She had to go back because of a visa, but we were together for 6 months.
Yeah. 6 months? Yeah. So you guys hooked up and then did a road trip? So half of your trip was with her?
Yeah, well, that was just towards the end. So that kind of extended the trip.
Okay.
Because it was Zion, so I was actually on my way back already.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, and then because I hit the Canadian Rockies. I was in the Canadian Rockies for probably 3 months, and then I just followed the Rockies downward. And so that ended up, then I was heading for Zion, and that's where I met her. And then I ended up going this way, and went here, and then we headed south, went down to, you know, Saguaro and stuff.
Would that have been the first time you saw the Grand Canyon, was on that?
No.
Okay.
No,
no. Okay. Did your parents bring you first to the Grand Canyon?
Yeah. I was a kid. Okay. I don't know how old I was, yes, but the first time I ever really got anything about Grand Canyon was actually my kindergarten teacher. And she had come to the Grand Canyon, and she was showing slides.
Oh.
And carrying it. And I, for some reason, I remember very vividly, you know, that this Grand Canyon class. But eventually, my parents brought me to the Grand Canyon, and I looked in, and I traveled enough, even as a kid, that I knew that the lower you go, the hotter it gets.
Oh, okay.
Okay, and so I'm standing on the rim, it's summertime, and I could, and it was like 80 degrees. And I said, it must be 100 degrees down there, you know, and I think, and I remember looking, and I remember seeing the Black Bridge, you know, I was at the Geology Museum, and they had the full topographic map then. And I wish they never took that away. That was nice. and I could see the Black Bridge, and I said to myself, you know, only an idiot would go down there. That's what my first thought of seeing the Grand Canyon. And then I came to Grand Canyon another time where somebody, an interpreter, showed me in a telescope by Yavapai, showed me this waterfall. And I looked at the scope, and then I looked over the eyes, and I could just barely see, which now I have, you know, later, in when I came, practically moved in here, learned that it was Shava Falls.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, so that was pretty neat. But, yeah, and then in the 70s, when I had my own car, my Datsun, I came to this park and actually hiked in. So that would have been...
That's your first hike.
Yeah, that's probably would be the last half of the same. So I graduated in 74, you know.
Okay.
And so it's when I got a car. And so I hiked in, and I was a little bit worried about the hike. So I decided to get a dorm.
Okay.
And it was $8.25.
Fantastic.
And
it still the tent, or had they already built the dorms as we know?
It was still the, yeah. It was the way it is now.
It's the way it is.
It was
now.
It is now. Yeah. And so I hiked in. And
down the Kaibab.
Down the Kaibab, and it was just a one nighter.
Okay.
I hiked in, and I brought my own food. I made my own sandwiches. Because to keep the cost down and stuff like that, and I stayed in the dorm. And then I made the mistake the next morning is to leave before breakfast. So I said, I can eat my breakfast when I get to where the trail leaves the river. And then on the way there, by those sand dunes along the river trail, I started feeling I was gonna keel over.
Oh, wow.
And so when I got to the beach there, I ate those sandwiches, and then I felt much better. And then I started heading up, and then you got that first view of the South Rim, and I thought, oh man, look what I got myself into here. But I made it okay. I made it all the way out, and then the rest of the day, I just sat there on the rim, just looking down the canyon. It's all, 'cause now all of a sudden I realized what it was. You know, you definitely don't get it when you don't go in the canyon. Yeah. You don't get it. And I just stared at it, just couldn't believe it. And I got a beer and I just enjoyed the canyon. So 4 months later, I came back, but this time with my sister, my dad, and my sister's boyfriend, which is now who she's married with. And we went down the Kaibab, and we had two nights. I said, we got to have two nights. And we, again, stayed in the dorms. And anyway, when we got down to the boat beach, the beach was bigger.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it was big enough for a volleyball court. It was, you know, that big. And there was this woman coming off a boat, and she slipped and broke her ankle.
Oh.
Right in front of us. And the rangers had to come. And she ended up being medevaced. And so that was my first medevac.
And you've seen hundreds since then.
Yeah, yeah. So that was interesting. But this whole river trip, you know, like, the woman had a granddaughter that was on the boat. And so what was the deal? You know, is she going to stay? And she was right on that age where, you know, she would be underage. She was just kind of on the edge there, and something like that. Something was going on. But anyway, the grandmother gave permission for that she could stay on the river trip. And then my dad tried to push me, hey, you should go on that river trip.
Take her place.
Yeah, you know, take her place. And I thought, no, that's okay. But I don't know if they're even allowed to do that. But anyway, and off they went. And then, anyway, I ended up hike out with my family, and that was my first trip. But anyway, the whole idea of doing a river trip in the canyon, like, wow, that would be really good. But I had no money.
Yeah.
It's just a thought.
This is the late 70s.
This is late 70s, yeah, late 70s. And then, so anyway, then in the 80s, so I did more traveling overseas, went to Africa, went to Europe, Asia.
Did you go to Indonesia?
Oh yeah, I definitely went there. Saw family.
Wow.
Yeah. So that 4 year period. So I did that trip around the United States, and so I did a whole bunch of traveling, and in between I did work a little bit, and then finally I had to go back to that boss, and I said, he goes, well, you can get your job back when you come back, and I said, you know, you need to look for somebody else, because this is going to get worse. Because I don't know if you noticed, I mean, the trips are getting longer.
They're getting longer.
And I don't think you should be relying on me anymore. So that's he went for that. And luckily he did that, because I never went back as a tea repairman.
I know you've told me that you're not very good at remembering dates and years and things like that. But is there, excuse me, an approximate time that you did your last TV repair?
Yeah, it would have been, yeah, so I did the 81 trip, and then I worked again, and I was still with the German girl, and I was still living in back that house, and so I worked again, and within a year, I had to go again.
So about 1982.
Yeah, something like that, And then I went to Africa, and I had this trying to plan trips, but the way the planning was, it was kind of hard to do. I was just trying to do a round of thing, but you couldn't figure out really good. But there were these great loops.
Yeah.
So anyway, you know, we didn't have internet, so it was I was doing a lot of research, and I was requesting from different countries information, all that stuff. And so my parents noticed what I was doing, and I said that I was heading for Africa, but I couldn't find a cheap way of doing it, you know, because even if I got there, You can't just walk into a national park because there's animals that eat you there, okay? And so, but I did, I'm not even sure how I found this, but I found an actual company that did trips into the national parks. And this guy had never done it before. He was a German guy, and he had just bought he spent a lot of time in Germany, in Africa. He bought himself a Mercedes truck, and he was going to start this business. And and my parents, they wanted to go real bad. So we went, all three of us, we went.
Fantastic.
Yeah, and it was a lot cheaper than, you know, because when you rented a car there, it had to be some, at least a Rover.
Uh-huh.
And they not only charged, they didn't charge by mile, they charged by kilometer. And when you buy gas, they charge by, by the liter. And so it was just totally ridiculous how much it would cost. But this way, it was a lot cheaper. And so we went in there. But we went on KLM, which is a Dutch airline. And so we actually went through Holland on both ways.
Right.
And that gave me a chance to go visit my German girlfriend who was back in Germany at the time. Yeah.
By the way, I want to catch her name.
Kirsten, yeah.
Last name?
I can't remember. It starts with an H. That's all I remember. Like Hostmiller or something like that.
Okay.
Yeah. It was a long time ago.
Yeah.
We didn't keep in touch.
Yeah, but you were with her for a year. I mean, that's a significant relationship.
Yeah, 6 months. And then I met up with her. We had split up, but then we got together for a few days again.
So when you say Africa, I'm thinking East Africa. Kind of like Kenya, Tanzania.
Kenya. Yeah, I was in Kenya.
You were in Kenya.
Yeah.
So you and your parents traveled around with this guy.
Yeah.
He was starting a company, so I guess you were clients.
Yeah, we were clients. Yeah. So that's not like me to do something like that.
But your parents were there. They probably.
Yeah. And so we went to Tsavo National Park, east and west. And that's where Mazima Springs is.
What's the name of the park?
Tsavo.
Tsavo.
Yeah. Tvavo.
Oh, yeah.
And it's west and east. And we went to Mazima Springs because I had read about it in National Geographic. And we went there. And then Samburu.
Masai Mara?
Masai Mara, that's a real good one.
Yeah.
So we were on the Serengeti. We did a balloon ride.
Fantastic. And this is way early in the safari game.
Yeah, and
it wasn't like it is now.
Yeah, and you can see Kilimanjaro and Mount Kenya. Yeah, it was pretty neat. We also went to the coast.
Dar es Salaam?
Mombasa.
Mombasa?
Mombasa.
Did you go to Zanzibar?
No, didn't go to Zanzibar. Okay. Yeah, so that was pretty neat.
How long was that trip?
It was not real long. It was 3 weeks.
But going to Africa like that, that sort of just pushed you a little bit farther into the national park idea.
Yeah. That's exactly what it did. And then I came back. Then we spent some time in Europe. And then we came back. And then I was here 2 months in L.A.
Uh-huh.
And then I took off on my trip around the Pacific Ocean.
And that
took 1 year.
So this is probably 1983 or 1984.
It would be, pardon, I think 82.
82,
in 83. Yeah, and
So talk about this Pacific trip. Are you going by boat, by ship?
By plane. Yeah, so you could, I'm not sure if they have these ideals anymore, but the deal was for $1,700, you can make the whole loop, and you can pick where you want to land, as long as you want on the track. It was done with Singapore Airlines with Air New Zealand.
Oh, fantastic.
Yeah.
As long as you're going in one direction.
In the loop, yeah.
You
couldn't backtrack.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. But you could do side trips.
Yeah.
You just got to get back to that point again. And, so it was very interesting because the only reservation I had to make was the first one to get out of L.A.
To Hawaii, I'm guessing?
I went to, I think my first stop, I think, was It was either Taipei or Hong Kong was my first one.
Okay.
Yeah. Because I had been to Hawaii before a few times.
Okay.
Yeah. But, yeah, and then, yeah, and I went to Singapore, Bangkok, you know, hang around there for a while. And then I bought a plane ticket to Nepal.
Above and beyond this $1,700.
Yeah, right, yeah. I went to Nepal, and I did a trek there in the Annapurnas.
Oh.
Yeah. And
those are long treks. Those are, yes, like 13 or 17 days.
Yeah, the one I did was 11 days. Mm-hmm. And that was pretty neat. I mean, and I really lucked out. I was there on full moon night, and it was completely clear.
Wow.
Yeah, it was really nice. And then I went back to Bangkok, where I bought that plane ticket. Then I went to Singapore, and there I bought a ticket to Medan, which is the main town of Sumatra. And I had family there. And they didn't know I was coming, actually. They had heard that I was on the move and that I could go there. And so, anyway, I got off, and I had this address, and someone with a rickshaw took me there. First, I went to an office, because I was trying to get a permit to go to this national park where I will properly pronounce it, orang-utans live. Orang means man.
Okay.
Utang means forest. And I know a little bit Malaysian. So,
okay.
And food names usually. But anyway, so then after I got that permit, then I went and found my family. And it was interesting because the rickshaw guy came to this, and I had this address. And he pointed at the house, but it was the wrong number. It was A. Mine was B. And so I said, well, I think it must be back there. So he walks with me back there, and then I look in through a window. There's no glass. It's just a chain link fence is the window. And I look and I see a painting of my grandmother. Yeah, and I thought, this is it. Yeah, and then I knocked on the door, and a cousin of mine came out, Telly, and she looked at me, and I said, I'm Shores from America, you know, and she just almost fainted. Yeah, and then she told the kids, go get your father, and anything like that. So that was interesting. Anyway, then, so I used her place as a base, and then I went from there, so I went to, Gunung Leuser, which is this national park, and that's where. So at that time, before that, actually, the orangutan people had them as pets.
Yeah.
And then it got to a point, I think, that there was probably some issues that people were like, because they're so human-like, it's almost like a slave thing.
Yeah.
And so they outlawed it. So anybody who had an orangutan at home that was less than 2 years old had to give them up. If they're older, so they put them in different national parks, and it was working together with the World Wildlife Fund.
Uh-huh.
and they set this up. So then the orangutans were brought there. First they were quarantined to make sure they don't have, because they carry human diseases. So I was there for, you know, it was for a little bit, and helping the rangers and stuff out, you know, for a few weeks. Yeah, it was pretty
neat. Let me just take a break here just to make sure we've got all this.
Yeah, so anyway, going back. I was in, like, Indonesia for, like, about 6 weeks, and I spent only $75.
Wow.
Yeah. And then I went back to Singapore, and then I just went to the airport, and I said, I want to get to on a next flight to Sydney. And the woman looks at me, and she goes, it's already moving. And I go, oh, and I missed it? No, just that. So she started telling me then what was going on like this. And so she's getting it all ready. So I give her my backpack. She goes, no, you don't understand. You have to walk to the plane. It's out there on the tarmac waiting for you. And so I said, okay. And she's telling me which way to go. And I go like this. And the doors open, they let me through. And,
oh, my God.
Yeah, and it's like, and then and I see a truck with a letter going up to the plane, and a door opens, I go up there, and the stewardess opens it up and says, put your pack there, sit here. You can imagine they would never do that here. Now, there's no way they'd ever do that.
I've been on flights where you can see the plane, but as soon as they close the door, they won't even look at you.
Yeah.
And the plane is sitting there with the jetway still going to.
Yeah.
But they close the door, yeah. And that's the rules.
Yeah. Yeah, so basically I went to Australia, stayed there for about two and a half months, and then two and a half months in New Zealand, where I actually got engaged, but we bailed out of it.
A Kiwi lady?
Yeah. Actually, I met her in Australia. And then we were together. And then the big thing came. I had heard that, I think it was Mauna Loa, had just erupted and was sending a lava flow towards Hilo. And so I flew there. Okay.
But that's going backwards.
No, because I'm making the loop. So
it's a loop around the Pacific. Got you. I thought it was one way around the globe.
No.
It's a loop around the Pacific.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yes. And, but by the time I got there, that was, and, you know, first I went to Oahu, and then a flight to the Big Island. And by the time I got to Hilo there, I can see smoking out there but you can see it, the lava had stopped and never hit Hilo. And then I went straight to the park. And there, I talked to a ranger and said, everything kind of mellowed out, whatever. So anyway, then about 6 o'clock, I hear boom, boom. And I ran up this hill, which turned out to be a crevasse. And I got out of the hill and it was a big drop. And I can see a glow out there, way out there. And something happened. And then I went back to my cast, and immediately the ranger comes in. It just went off. Kilauea just went off. And so the next morning, I didn't have food because I had just got there by the bus. And so I had to hitchhike. And the first car picks me up. And they go, we heard the eruption. And so I kind of had a fib. I said, well, maybe we should go to a visitor center and find out some information. Because I had to get a permit. So I ended there. So I ran and got in a permit to go backpacking. And then, and also I went to the store and get some food, but a little bit of food. And so we drove up to this place, and we climbed up, we went up on this hill where you can see the eruption and going. But it was 5 miles away.
Okay.
And you could just see it kind of going over
and
there.
And it was on Mauna Loa.
It was on the slopes.
Slopes of Mauna Loa.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And and that one had been erupting like almost every month. And the ranger told me that it lasts about 24 hours. And then, you know, and it started at 6, you know. And so anyway, I took off, got off the hill, and I started going for it. And there's following these rock cairns. And I get to a point where I am 3 miles away. I think it was closer, but it was, about 3 miles away. I was 3 miles away, but I had a clear shot of the eruption going. And there was other people camped there. And it was snowing rocks and Paley's hair everywhere.
On top of your camp?
Atop everybody. And the rocks were light.
So pumicey.
And so all I did is I just put my umbrella on the ground, so I even caught some. And if I broke it open fast enough, I could actually feel a little bit warmth in it.
Wow.
But it were pretty well cooled off. But this was going on, you know, throughout the day. And so me and this guy decided to sneak closer, which we were told, you know, we were told not to do it. So there was a guy I met, and he was also on the loop, but the opposite direction. That was the trick, too, about him. And so, and the people that there was some, the people that gave me a ride also walked with me out there. But they had to go back, and they took pictures of me in front of the volcano. Oh. Yeah.
You still have those?
Yeah, I still have those. Yeah, they sent it to me. And so, but it was 3 miles away. Okay. And then, so me, this Australian guy, we snuck down, and we were going through all these weird lava things. There was lava pits, and these pits where the tree used to be, and the trunk burned out, and some of them were grown up, so you had to be really careful where you were going. And then when you got, and then there was copters, and we were told that the research copters and NPS copters, and we were told if we get caught, they would find us and confiscate everything. They threatened us, but I said it's worth it. And so we went and got closer, and we finally, and also because this is the Mauna Loa slope, so it's here, it's the volcano, and we're up here, but the lava was falling on the other side, so we just saw the lava that was being in the air, but not seeing where it was going.
Okay.
And so what we started doing, then we finally came through a lava forest where the trees were still, you know, the lava apparently must have kept going and left the lava on the tree, and then the tree burned out. So there were these the main trunk, and we were going through all that. And we finally started passing the hill that it was on. And so we went past it, and then we got to see the actual falling onto the slope. But we didn't stay long, because there, you know, the closer you get to the equator, you know, the lights just shut off, right? Yeah, in the evening, hardly any twilight. So we went back because we didn't want to be in that field. And then we had to climb back out of the crater too. It was just all craters everywhere. And then 6 o'clock starts coming, and it starts getting darker, and the lava starts going down. And I thought, oh man, it's, you know, okay, just like what the rain shared, 24 hours. Wrong. Soon it got dark, it came right back up, and it became this huge spout. And then so we all watched it, and I think it was like 20, 30 people there, all camping there, wow, backpacking. And we watched it, and I said, all the stuff flying out of I had to eat in my tent because I was scared I was going to swallow the Paley's hair, just like fiberglass.
Yeah.
And then, so the lava went up, and then at 10 o'clock, there's vents everywhere, but the vents started getting more and more and more, and so this was like steam or something, and finally it got so steamy you couldn't see the volcano anymore. You could just see this glow in the mist, and so everybody started falling asleep, and so I went to sleep, and then at 2 o'clock in the morning, also I get woken up. It's loud again, and my whole campsite is lit. So I look out the window, and there's all the fog is gone, and now we got a full view of the lava flow, and then the wind must have changed. That's probably what blew the fog away. And now the lava was being pushed on our side. Oh. But we're safe because there's a big old hole in front of us, and it was going on this side, and one lava flow went that way, and another flow went like that way, and was catching the forest on fire. And nobody was awake except for me. So I had to run around and wake everybody up. Wake up. And then it went for the rest of the night till morning. And then all of a sudden it fizzled out.
What a great experience.
Yeah.
Was that the last stop on the Pacific trip?
Pretty much.
The Big Island?
Yeah. Oh, it made it safe for me too, because I was kind of pushing it, because I wasn't a U.S. citizen at the time. And if I don't get back back on U.S. soil, I lose my visa. So by getting on Hawaii, you know, I was for sure I was going to make it.
Is this even true for your parents and your sister, that they didn't have their passports yet? Were they still guests? Or
my sister probably did by then. Okay. I'm not sure. My parents didn't.
We haven't mentioned your sister, but what's her name?
Lucia.
Lucia.
Yeah, here so they call her Louise. Yeah.
There's two of you then?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. And then, then I came back, worked for this company that made stuff for rockets and space shuttle. And I was like the delivery boy. I didn't want to go back to TV. And in Torrance. And then I joined a whale watch thing. Whale watching I've been doing since the 70s, actually.
I'm going to stop you right there because we're going to go to a different recording.
Uh-huh.
It sounds like we're getting closer to a time where the people here at Grand Canyon are going to be interested in. So let me just stop this one right now.
Okay. Yeah, there's one thing I want to say, though.
Okay.
On this one. Okay, one of the things that when I saw that volcano, is why I decided never go back to the TV repair.
Oh, really?
Yeah, and I said that there's too many things on this planet that's going on for me to be wasting my time doing TV repair. Okay, so that's right. So I'm going to slow down and start looking at things because even after traveling all those places, I always kind of felt I was a visitor.
Uh-huh.
And I said, I need to slow down, okay?
Oh, the volcano did it.
Yeah, the volcano did it, yeah. And so they then, so when I came back, I missed the trip. When I came back, I was first 2 weeks in L.A., and then I drove to Alaska for 6 months. And then I came back and started working, yeah.
Okay, well, we'll pick up with Alaska and just hear a little bit about that, and then we'll get into the whale watching, and I think pretty soon we're going to be transitioning into Grand Canyon. And I'm just going to take a picture or two of us sitting here in Campsite 11 of Bright Angel Campground, just so you can see the environment where this interview is happening. Thank you, Shores.
Yeah.